Welcome to the Sub Pop Cult Podcast. I'm your host, Mike McGruther. On today's episode, I've invited the former acting head of public corruption at the FBI, Jeff Cortese, to come on my show and talk a little bit about a Ponzi scheme that happened in Hollywood, where an actor bilked investors out of $690 million. $690 million is no small amount of money. And it was all done by playing the Hollywood game, using the fame and the glamour to attract people to an enticing money-making opportunity that always looks so good from the outside and is so wrong when you start to find the actual details. It's a lot like what happens to talent. On the outside, the industry looks like a fun playground of acting and directing and writing, and those things do happen, but the majority of your time, unfortunately, in the culture of Hollywood is spent scamming, conning, coercion, persuasion, sticking a knife in the other guy's back when he's turned the other way. It's a cutthroat business, and because of that, it attracts all the wrong people. Let's start with this big case that had to do with my business, show business. This big Ponzi scheme by Zach Horowitz. He was an actor, a wannabe actor, a guy who hung out with a lot of friends and they all kind of went off to be successful bankers. And he had that flair for show business and fame. And he was able to get $690 million out of investors around the country that thought they were investing in motion pictures. This is unbelievable to me because it's very hard to raise money and it's very hard to find investors to do art. So when you look at something like this, how does a guy like that pull this off? What was so attractive? How did his corruption work so well that he was able to pull this off? I can't get $1 million from anyone to make an independent film. This guy can get $690 million to make Satan's Bride and other things that he invented that didn't even exist. Like, what was that magic ingredient that enabled that fraud to work?
Yeah, that's a great... First of all, thanks for having me. We're super happy to be here. Like you said, we've been friends for a long time. This is an interesting case. Obviously, you know, fraud is one of those things that is a global, talk about global pandemic. Fraud is certainly one of them. And the reason it is so popular is because it works. Now, there are various types of fraud schemes that exist. Some of them are a numbers game. You know, if you look at the say the Nigerian fraud schemes that you get, the emails, right? You know, they're sending thousands, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, however many emails out. And if they just get a small fraction to respond, it's worth the effort. It's a small effort for a big win. You know, when I was working at the FBI, we rotate around complaint duty. All the agents work it in kind of a secular fashion.
What is complaint duty?
Yeah, good question. So complaint duty is, it could be different in different offices. It could be a combination of what are called walk-ins. So people are walking into the FBI to file a complaint or make a complaint rather, or telephone. Okay. It could be one or the other. It could be both. Depends on the size of the office. But it was very common to spend a good chunk of your day dealing with online fraud schemes and addressing these kinds of things. I was actually speaking to somebody yesterday about a fraud scheme that, you know, one phone call I had received, I think it was in New Orleans at the time. And he called and he said, listen, I got an email about winning the Canadian lottery. The email just says that I have to pay the taxes up front. I just want to, this isn't real, right? I mean, is it real? I said, well, sir, did you play the Canadian lottery? He said, no. I said, you know what the odds are of winning the lottery when you play it? Not very good. What do you think they are when you don't play? Right. So that the and this is, you know, and he laughed and, you know, we laughed it off and moved on. But it was so enticing. Everybody is always looking for their big win, and winning can be hard. So if somebody wants to come around and make winning easy, then it's very attractive. And a good fraudster is able to make you feel like you won easy. And from reading the article, if I, you know, understood the details, like I said, it was just that article and I've read some other details. It sounds like he was promising returns. There's a reason the SEC does not allow an investment advisor to promise guaranteed returns to people, because it entices people to invest. Guaranteed money? Are you kidding me? That's great. 35%? That's unheard of. You're not going to find that anywhere. You take all my money. And so part of why it works is he was able to sell the lie. And fraud is all about selling the lie.
And the lie in this case is so attractive, I would argue, because glamour is such a strong pull on people feeling like their self-worth has been achieved. It's tangible to say, hey, I paid for all those Netflix movies. The guy wants to brag at the cocktail party back in Detroit or wherever these investors came from. And it plays to that part of their ego, which is just so different than other areas where somebody who's craving pure power. So I just kind of wonder, in your opinion, is a fraudster who's after just corrupting power, is he worse for society than these guys who are just, they're like self-imploding on their human desires to be around women and money and first class this and, you know, that lifestyle? Like, which one is the worst impact on all of us?
Boy, that's a tough one to answer. There's so many different fraud schemes out there, and they're all bad in their own way for different reasons. And some of them share some of the same reasons. Taking somebody, peeling money away from somebody under a ruse or under the guise of false information is not okay. Elder fraud, elder abuse, boy, that is some horrible stuff. So I don't know how you categorize it. But to your point, I think it is not lost on me that there is an added sexiness, an added appeal to the fact that it was a Hollywood fraud. Or the fact that it was related to Hollywood. There is an inherent attraction that people have to that lifestyle, fame. You look at social media and the number of folks out there that are quote unquote influencers that, you know, live their life on likes. Hollywood is the ultimate manifestation, or I don't know, maybe it's the foundation of social media. It is the living your life on likes. World. And so it's attractive. It comes with power. It comes with influence. So there is no doubt an added level of attractiveness for those who were defrauded, given it was Hollywood and not, you know, a sanitation scheme.
Right. So it makes it easier to pull off by probably a significant factor, because the guy goes to hotels and he meets with people and he shows them contracts that are bogus, where he just put the Netflix logo or the HBO logo on top. And, you know, I know people who are entertainers that would walk around with record deals that weren't theirs, but they told everyone they were theirs. It's just, that's the kind of show and tell game that's going on.
A fraudster is nothing but a writer, right?
Yeah.
You write what you know. This was an industry he knew. He worked in it. He was around it. He knew what it would take. He knew how to sell it. He knew what it took to make it all look legit. And so he wrote his story and he was able to sell people the pages.
So fraud is narrative too, then. It's just really convincing narrative.
Well, there are in some ways,
because, you know, obviously he's bilked people and got them on board with that. That's interesting. But, you know, as I read the article and as I looked at it, that was just where my brain went, was who is this guy really hurting compared to, you know, like the other levels of corruption that can really hurt people who are in need. It just seems like a bunch of wealthy people got suckered by a con man who came from Con Man Central, which is Hollywood, California.
Yeah, no, and I agree. But I don't think you're saying this, so I do want to clarify it. I mean, it's not less offensive because these people had money.
No.
Right? It's not less offensive because their house is bigger and they had more money to lose than I do. You know, the fraud is the fraud. People get hurt. Lives get ruined. Families and relationships get destroyed. You know, and so that's why it's really difficult to gauge. You know, is a $5 fraud worse than a $500 million fraud? I guess it depends on how good the relationships are in their lives and how much money they have. You know, $5 is all you have. But, you know, and I know you weren't. Yeah.
No, one family lost everything. They had their entire $10 million savings was gone. They were the first to sue. And when they sued, Netflix said, we have no idea who this guy is. So I didn't mean it in that way. What I meant is this game exists and has existed, particularly in this business that I know about, for a long time, where I've seen scores of movies get financed out of nowhere that everybody has a job on and they're taking a check. And you just wonder what the hell's going on. I mean, this guy had a law firm representing him, and then they pulled back only when it got a little too, you know, too hot, I guess I'll say, for lack of better words. So when I read into this, I just wonder, this is might be the beginning of a bigger story here, because this is something that I've seen happen over and over and over again, but I've actually seen a movie come out of it, even if it's as terrible as can be, and you know they never made it to make a profit. There was some kind of money laundering going on, is in my cynical view. What a lot of people don't know is that when you get a budget from a movie studio like Warner Brothers, and they say to you, you're gonna spend $50 million, you really spend it all right back at Warner Brothers. It kind of never goes anywhere. So in some way, that's what these fraudsters are kind of emulating on the other side. They're taking people's money and they're cycling it into a system that it never leaves. Now, I hate to use the word systemic, but I feel like corruption is systemic in show business. That's just my view.
I hear you. And I think the issue is, you know, corruption can be found where you find money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the two kind of go hand in hand. I mean, it doesn't do a corrupt individual any good to have a government position that has no access to money, and there's no money to be given out, or there are no contracts to be given out or anything like that. Right. So, you know, you find corruption in a general sense, wherever you might find money, there's always somebody looking to peel a few bucks away from somebody else for as little work as possible. And so Hollywood isn't going to be any different. You see it in big business. You know, every big company and institution has, you know, anti-corruption departments. They have ethics teams. They have internal reporting. You know, they put all these guardrails up to reduce the risk of their employees engaging in activity that's going to reflect poorly on the organization. Corruption being one of those. So where you have an industry that is so riddled with individual contractors and individual groups and organizations, yeah, you have the studios, but everybody's kind of working individually, trying to get their hands on a few of these bucks that are floating around. Like you talked about, you know, you're a Hollywood insider with some experience in what it takes to try to raise money for a movie. That's a hard thing to do. We've had those conversations. So when the money is actually acquired, when somebody does invest that money, boy, they come out of the woodworks to, you know, to get their hands on it.
Yeah.
But absent those guardrails that large institutions, and the large institutions still, you know, you go look at Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations. These are all enormous companies with very robust anti-corruption ethics programs. So even with the guardrails, you can't prevent it. So what happens when you don't have the guardrails?
Yeah, because that was my next question is, there are no guardrails in the entertainment industry that I know of. It's the only industry I know of that doesn't really have a human resources department. It doesn't have an organized central rulemaking body that is transparent in any way, that there's somebody you can complain to or that you could report corruption to. Because like you said, everybody's an individual contractor starting up, you know, small little enterprises in the forms of movie investments that are inflated and deflated instantly. And then there's some profit made. So let's move to this other thing that I want to talk to you about. And I hope that that we can get into it a little bit. But there was a case, and it involved people making movies in a very popular place to make movies in the 90s, which was Louisiana, specifically down in New Orleans. I know a lot of actors that went there. It kind of came like a big wave out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, everybody I knew was doing a shoot in New Orleans for a couple weeks. And when I looked into it and I attended some film classes and film investing workshops, I started to learn about incentives that were put out by states and that people like myself could apply and you could get a movie made. And there was some corruption that was happening. And obviously, as you had just stated, you're never going to prevent it in any one of these situations from evolving. So there was some corruption there, and people can look you up online and find this really cool picture of you from years back arresting the film commissioner.
Well, I wasn't arresting the film commissioner.
Well, walking him out. He was doing the perp walk with you, whatever it is, but it's a great picture.
I think it was a search warrant at the film company.
Okay, and so that just tells me that you have some insight into what was going on there. And I find it fascinating, and I just wonder if you can tell listeners of this podcast, which is not a lot of people, it's a handful of people, if you can tell us anything about what led to that moment where you're in that picture, because that's an interesting situation that I think isn't unique to Louisiana. It's ongoing in every state that has kickbacks. And I don't think people look closely at this very much and realize what kind of corruption potential is happening where people are skimming off state funds.
Some backstory. Louisiana, I believe, was the first state in the country after, I think, Canada. I think Canada kind of initiated this process. So they started to get a big influx. So if, you know, a lot of folks' favorite shows, as you know, are filmed in Canada. Right. And it's filmed there because of their tax incentives, their filmmaking tax incentives. Louisiana saw that and they said, hey, we need to do something like that here. So in the early 2000s, Louisiana passed its state film tax credit. And now it evolved over the years. But what that did was attract a ton of business. So in simple terms, if a filmmaker, Joe producer from California, wanted to make a film, he saw that Louisiana had a film tax credit. He could, let's say it's theoretically 20%. So he can go to Louisiana, pay $100 million in Louisiana making his film, and receive $20 million back in the form of a tax credit. Now, Joe Producer doesn't pay taxes in Louisiana, so that doesn't do him a whole heck of a lot of good. So that created a secondary market for these. So what he would then do is, if he had $20 million in Louisiana tax credits from making his film, he would, that's dollar for dollar. That's not a tax write-off, that's a tax credit. So that's real money. He could then cut that up or sell it in one lump sum to a broker, or he could do it on his own, sell it to somebody in Louisiana that needs $20 million worth in state tax credits. And so he might sell it for, 75 cents on the dollar. So he might get, three quarters of that money back in his pocket. He's happy. He just got, $15 million or so. He's going to go on his way, already ahead of the game. And the film hasn't even been finished. Hasn't even hit the can yet. It's not done yet. So that's what was attracting people. I don't know if it was Forbes or Inc. or Money or one of those magazines, I think, or someone else, started calling Louisiana Hollywood South. They were getting so much business. They actually evolved into the third largest production state in the country behind California and New York. So this this dawn of this tax credit created a lot of opportunity in Louisiana.
And I had the years wrong. You're saying this is in the 2000s already.
Yes.
So this is like around 2002, 2003?
Going by memory. I'd have to look it up to know exactly when it was first initiated.
Everything but, falls into the 90s for me. So.
Yeah, you know, and I started looking into it in about 2006 is when we started, when I started looking into it, and a colleague of mine. And it was maybe on its second iteration. You know, it had continued to evolve, and there were plenty of lobbyists trying to bolster the incentives and whatnot.
Oh, and I know it was
a lot of confusion, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was a huge deal. It was a ton of confusion. They were the big test case. Louisiana was, you know, what expenses count? What expenses don't count? How do we audit? How do you reconcile all this stuff, right?
And almost how much money does it bring to the state in just
how much is it
spending
worth?
Money?
Exactly. They spend $100 million. Are they really spending $100 million here? And is it really giving that state the incentive to justify giving $20 million back? And so that's kind of how it started. In Georgia is another, you know, huge production state. New Mexico and slowly across the country, all these states started coming up with their own film tax credits and incentives. So that's in essence how it started. That's how it started, how it ended.
Yes. How do we get to the picture? We're working our way to the picture with whatever
we
can know.
Was that the state film commissioner, Mark Smith, pled guilty to accepting bribes from a film producer in Louisiana who was able to corner the market. And he was able to corner the market because he was able to receive tax credits on things that he shouldn't have.
It always seems like it always boils down to whenever the crime is committed, it's one greedy person who had to take everybody else's opportunity and consolidate them into his own profit.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's supposed to be, every system kind of gets corrupted that's incentivized like this, where one thing is supposed to happen and then the other things happen where people are lining their pockets.
Right. Yeah. This is supposed to be something that's going to ultimately become a benefit for Louisiana, and it ended up really kind of hurting them.
Right.
I think there was another film tax credit case out of Louisiana that happened after I left. They've had them in California. I think they've had them in, you know, they've had them in other states as well. It is free money. It is attractive. There is a ton of value there. The California, you know, Joe producer comes to Louisiana. He's like, hey, I know you guys have a tax credit, but I don't know how it works. Who do I talk to? Boom, go talk to this guy.
Right.
This guy's like, hey, I'll take care of everything for you, right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and then next, he's just getting his money. He's happy. He's getting his tax credits and everything else. He doesn't really understand what's going on and how this guy got to be the guy. But he became the guy. And you know, I find, you know, Mark Smith, who was the film commissioner, I can't say there are a lot of people I've arrested that I didn't find something that I liked about them. Even if it was small, I mean, you find, and that's part of the process of investigating these guys and then ultimately interrogating them. Is building this rapport. You have to build a rapport with them. And so in the process of that, it's hard not to find something. There are certainly plenty that I've like, man, I'm looking really hard to find something I like.
Yeah.
But Mark Smith was a guy that, you know, I really did like, and a lot of people liked him, and he was a likable guy. I haven't talked to him since then, but, you know, and there were circumstances surrounding his decisions, and they were the wrong decisions.
Yeah.
The film producer, I don't think he's not alive anymore. I'm not sure what happened. They all served their time. It was ultimately the film producer, a middleman, attorney, and the film commissioner for the state of Louisiana. Kind of, it was a kind of big deal at the time.
Yeah.
Because the state film tax credit phenomenon was in its prime. Louisiana was evolving into new ideas and new tax credits.
Multiple states have it now. I mean, we have it in Pennsylvania. It's all over the place. Everybody wants to attract production. And I noticed, because I've attempted to do this, I've attempted to make a film and access the New York State program, but every state also has a lot of stories already where they're like, oh, well, yeah, you'll never get paid, or this is crooked or that's crooked. So, well, thanks for sharing that with us. I know that there's probably a lot more excitement there that nobody can know, but that picture always strikes me as hysterical. And it's one of the things if I had to have a picture of you in my wallet, that's the picture I'd have in my wallet.
Well, so, I'm finding out for the first time you don't have a picture of me in your wallet.
Yeah, so now you know. Now I want to bring you into the world that you have entered, my arena, writing. You have taken a dive. You are writing your first book, and it's not – I've read your creative writing. You're an excellent creative writer, and you're really – you're a funny guy, and you're the screenplays that you've written, because, you know, everybody likes movies and writes screenplays. You are an excellent, excellent writer.
But your
first book is going to be the book on corruption. No pressure at all. So how's it going? How's this process working out for you? How does it feel to be in my position now? With a loaded gun to your head, essentially, and you're finishing your novel, but it's not a novel. It's got to be factually correct. What's that like? What's that feeling?
It feels like this was a much better idea before the publisher said yes. That, you know, once they said yes, things got real quick.
Yeah.
And boy, I don't know how to explain it. I get the question a lot, and it is usually followed by a great deal of silence. This is a podcast, so I don't think.
No, I mean, you're honestly, I got to tell listeners, this is a real writer talking, because he's not talking. Anybody that's like, well, yes, I'm on chapter 75 and word 100, like, those people are not really writers. Real writers hate it.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
It's really, I look forward to the day that I look back and say I liked it, you know. I suspect it is similar to childbirth. I have no personal, you know, I haven't physically experienced that. I have 5 kids, so I've from arm's length away, or I've experienced childbirth, but I would imagine it's a lot like when you're done, you're so happy that you forget about all the pain that you went through getting there.
Yes.
And you're like, I'm going to go do that again.
Yes, that's exactly right. Or the other way to describe it.
When you're in the middle of it, oh my gosh, I forgot. This is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, it's like bringing home a puppy. What did I do?
Right. I mean, it's great. It's I'm honored to be in a position where there are people who care about what I have to say on the topic. I'm humbled by that.
Let me stop you.
Responsibility.
Let me stop you. I mean, people don't know what your book's about, so we'll tell them a little bit about it. I mean, it's about corruption, but it's an incredibly important piece of work that you're working on, because, you know, as I awkwardly started this conversation with you, it's late at night for me. This isn't my best hour for talking. There is this misunderstanding of how the world of the Department of Justice and law enforcement, how it actually works. And because of that lack of understanding, it's made into an easy target to aggravate voters. And I don't think that's fair. And I think your book is going to remedy that. And that is why I'm excited to talk about it and give people just a little bit of a taste of what you're doing, because there's always something particular that we don't know that will only be found in the book that you're writing that doesn't exist. How amazed are you that this book doesn't even exist yet? That someone else didn't write this?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of books on corruption. They tend to either be very specific in their subject matter. So, you know, a book about Mining in Africa and the Corruption Around That, Around the Oil Industry, something of the sort, written by, you know, incredibly intelligent academics. And then you have books that are written that are political hit pieces. Let's see. I'm a Democrat. The Republican is in charge. I'm writing a book about corruption, and everyone in it is going to be a Republican, right? So it's a hit piece. Not to say that it's not accurate, but what I kind of committed to going.
It's like
into
a genre.
This,
it's a genre at this point.
It's a genre, but it, you know, there are. It fits well in the bookshelf of an echo chamber. Right. So among their people, the flags are waved and everybody's celebrating it because it's a great hit piece on everyone's enemy. But is it for, you know, how objective is it? Right. How honest is it? Well, as soon as you start to deviate away from objectivity, certain elements of deception start to seep in, or you coat things a certain way to prove the point you're making, because your point is what you're writing about, not the objective truth as you see it or experience it or whatever. And getting a little off on that.
No, but I mean, I think what you're saying is your and this is your online persona and your real life persona too. I can vouch for this. You're not interested in politics. You're not a political guy when it comes to left, right, or any of that. You know, I don't think it's a far stretch for anyone to understand that when you've jokingly said, "Hey, I've heard these people. I've been in the room with them." You know, you've been around these people more intimately than some of us, and it's not, they don't get a lot of your respect for very good reasons.
You're
not a fanboy of a politician. Like,
right.
You're never going to go to that extreme for anyone because you just know too much about the realities of doing those jobs.
Yeah, I mean, the guy or gal who coined the phrase "ignorance is bliss" was neither ignorant nor blissful anymore. you know, he knew too much, and that's why he was able to say that. And he's right. Ignorance is truly bliss. And the problem is, having worked public corruption, having been on the former Speaker of the House of Security Detail, a speaker who eventually was, caught up in his own child or sex abuse scandal when he was a high school teacher and ended up in federal prison for structuring. I mean, you know, I've been around a number of folks, listened when they knew I was there, listened when they didn't know I was there, right? All legally. But my point is that, you know, it's hard to walk away from that with anything less than a sour taste on not the necessarily the people, but the act of politicking.
Yes.
And so when I started thinking about, you know, do I want to do this law enforcement analysis thing and everything else, you know, the commitment I made to myself was, listen, I'm not going to do it from a viewpoint and then determine what I'm going to say based on that viewpoint. In other words, I'm not going to say I'm on the right, so therefore I'm going to have to say this, or I'm on the left, so therefore I have to say that, which is, it works in terms of like getting those likes and getting the popularity. Don't get me wrong. People love that. They want their outrage to be validated by somebody who's in the know. I would be considered in the know. If I validated the outrage of the right consistently, I'd have 30,000 followers. If I validated the outrage on the left, I'd have the same, right?
You'd have a million followers.
I've gone into this with the understanding like, hey, man, I just want to call balls and strikes. One of the biggest deficiencies in society, that's a laundry list, but as it relates to law enforcement, is a lack of education. And you touched on it earlier. We see it in use of force and the discussions that go on there. And we don't need to get into that. But my point was, the only way that I could justify engaging in these discussions is if I stayed consistent with what the original plan was. And the original plan is, I'm going to call balls and strikes to the extent that I can. You cannot eliminate entirely opinion. I am not a person who does not have opinions. I have my own opinions. I cannot eliminate those and put those away completely when I call balls and strikes, but I do what I can to view everything as objectively as possible, so that I can provide some, hopefully, some value to people who otherwise are being are surrounded by individuals who are really just trying to peel dollars and cents from their pocket by giving them what they want. And so I'm content with making zero on this, I'm content making no money on this and having, you know, 1900 followers on Twitter, as long as I'm hopefully consistent with my efforts, and that's trying diligently to stay true to the calling balls and strikes as I see them, and not letting the politics interfere. Now, I've tweeted this before. There are things of which I believe that I cannot be persuaded on, but there's a lot more that I believe that I can be persuaded on through discussion and conversation. And so I was having a discussion with somebody today who is ideologically on the opposite side of my views, but we have a very good relationship. And I say, listen, I've got friends with stripes of all colors and all types. The ability for us to continue to grow and educate ourselves and have fruitful discussion is a good thing. And I think people want that. But the dynamics, particularly on social media, really don't allow too much for that.
No, they don't. But I mean, that's the other reason why I wanted to make sure people understood that about you is when this book comes out, it's not a political book. And what is the title?
The title is Public Corruption in the United States, An Analysis of a Destructive Phenomenon. It's going to be published by Routledge.
And what was your potential title? Tell the audience. Come on, it's a good one. Especially people who follow you, and you always put pictures of food.
Oh, no. It's
still in
the book.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was the Corruption Cookbook.
No. That was a different book. I mean, and that was all just, I make my own recipes at home and everything. Oh. I do a lot of cooking, and I've created my own little notebook. But what I've called it is felonious cooking. It's a crime to eat this well.
And that one is partisan, because that one aims to fatten everybody up.
Oh, hey, all in moderation. I'm not saying you got to eat all of it, but you do have to taste it. Like I tell my kids. You don't have to eat all of it, but you sure as heck got to taste it. You got to try it.
That's right. And so the process has been intense for you. You're working your way towards finishing it. A lot of guys who have seen the things that you've seen and been the places you've been, I know you've penned some incredible screenplays, but we've talked about the movie business is just a weird situation. Can we get a book out of you one day? I've been begging you. Can we get a book? Can you write one of those amazing books, like about a guy, and you're telling us stuff that you can't really tell us, but you tell us in the book? Can't you do that?
So a fictional book with some real life stories with some changed names. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the kind where you write the little, this is not, there's nothing true about this whatsoever. Wink, wink, right. Nod, nod.
If this, what do they say? If it's
it's a coincidence.
Any similarities or a coincidence? Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Cause I know that, I know you got more than one great story in there. So
it's been a fun ride. It really has. I've loved every minute of it. And I am an apologist for law enforcement. I'm an advocate for law enforcement, but that cannot be and should not be confused with meaning, and that translating to everything law enforcement does is okay. I am an accountability guy above all else. And if the FBI messes up or people in the FBI mess up, they need to be held accountable. If people in law enforcement at any level, as much as I have admiration and respect for them and the work that they do, if they mess up, accountability is an absolute must in order to maintain and build relationships with the communities they serve. It is a very difficult job. It is has these men and women are exposed to things that, you know, people watch TV. You know, we've come full circle. We're talking Hollywood now, right?
I want to interject on that. I want to say to you, how do you feel about this dynamic between the way law enforcement is portrayed in movies and film and television and the way the news counters that? So it's like they give the audience these heroic characters in their shows, but then they won't tell us the heroic stories in real life.
Yeah, that's a good question. And when you juxtapose the two things, it's interesting, right? Everybody wants to play an FBI agent, but when the camera is on them, boy, they sure seem really quick to want to throw law enforcement under the bus. So that's an interesting point that you're bringing up. How do I feel about it?
I mean, how does that strike people? I would feel like I would never watch these shows if it was telling lies about the world that I knew was operated much differently, and I could see that it was being manipulated in such a way to.
Well, so I try to give the benefit of the doubt to those who don't know any better, or those if I'm not sure, I try to give the benefit of the doubt. We are inundated with information that forms our viewpoint, particularly on things that we don't know anything about, right? So if we don't know anything about law enforcement and everything we're getting about law enforcement is negative, then no wonder everybody thinks negative about law enforcement. So those who are driving that frustrate me is a polite way to put it, right? Pundits are trying to get book deals, politicians are trying to get reelected. Media folks want people to listen to their news, watch their news, read their news. So there's a motivation by many to create drama where drama might not exist. We take statistically small events or statistically lower probability events, and we blow them up into this idea that they are the norm. And those who don't know any better are going to absorb that and believe it. They're going to buy it. Those who do know better, obviously, are the people I'm most quote unquote frustrated with. Yeah. Those who don't are the people I'm trying to talk to. Those who don't know any better, the ones I'm trying to talk to, are the same ones that a lot of folks on social media, great, intelligent folks on from law enforcement who are out there just trying to communicate some truth out there. The problem is, man, it doesn't sell to say that a cop did it right.
Yeah, no, it's true. The conflict is in the drama is the conflict is everything. And that's right. That's what gets everyone to click and to watch.
I mean, there was a clip a year ago. I don't know. And again, you check my Twitter. I don't know what they call them, threads or Twitter
feed.
Ever. And I commented on it when it happened. I've commented a couple times since Joe Biden running for election. And this is not an anti-Joe Biden. I'm piecemealing out a single thing that he had done that I didn't like related to law enforcement. And he was talking to a community and he made reference to, you know, oh, we got to teach law enforcement to shoot in the leg and no more heart shots he was unarmed with a knife. He made the reference unarmed with a knife, which is, you know, given what we just experienced in the last couple of weeks, really kind of a relevant point, right? These little moments. Well, I mean, the guy spent 35 or however many years in Congress, surrounded by law enforcement. He's had security details. He knows that that's not right, but that's not what they wanted to hear, right? So when we take super important discussions, like voting, like law enforcement, things that we need to hold above the fray, things that we need to say, listen, you want to muddy all this other stuff up? Let's muddy this other stuff up. That's fine. That's part of the game. Some of this stuff used to be too holy to touch, for lack of a better word, too holy to touch. And it's no longer the case, right? So now people get outraged over information that they receive, but that creates a ripe environment for media exploitation, political exploitation, and pundit exploitation. You know, these activist groups are making money hand over fist based on premises that aren't true.
Right.
And what does that do? That creates a division. What maybe used to be a difference of opinion into an astronomical division between us now. So the opposing sides are so far apart from each other that, you know, it makes bringing them back together extremely difficult, extremely, extremely difficult. And so, like I said,
what you're hitting on, and it's an important point, is things that were once sacred to our public way of life, to our civil institutions. It's open season on those things. And I never thought I would really see a time where law enforcement and every civil organization was treated with such disrespect by the news media while simultaneously being treated as heroic in television shows. There must be a method to that. There must be some purpose behind that. And I think it has something to do with social engineering and just manipulating consumers so that they get their cake, but they also, the media gets their outrage. I don't know. But all I know is good people are lost in the middle of it. Regular people get confused by it. And like you said, it just creates a bigger and bigger divide between us. And really, we need voices like yours to be louder and louder and more out there so that this train doesn't just run away with everything. And that's how it feels. But, you know,
I probably should have given this some thought before I'm saying it, but I'm going to say it anyway.
All right.
It is as if media portrays, maybe Hollywood is portraying what real life is. You know, there's a reason Hollywood likes law enforcement stories, because they're great stories. They're about overcoming adversity. They're about
sacrifice,
solving problems. They're about sacrifice. They're about the underdog winning, right? This is what people love about the stories that make it into Hollywood. And so, it's funny, in some ways, the law enforcement portrayal in Hollywood, which is a world of fiction, is giving more truth in a lot of ways than sometimes the media, which is supposed to give the truth. And sometimes they tend to go the way of fiction or twisting things a little bit because it is in contrast to what people know. It's almost like the two have to be in conflict to be equally attractive. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess that's what I mean. There's something there.
If everybody loved law enforcement and everybody thought law enforcement was the greatest thing in the world, then maybe this stuff wouldn't be so much fun to watch. I don't know. I mean, it creates drama.
Something to it. Let's just put it that way. There's something going on there. There's never any, everything is never as simple as it seems when it comes to television programming, advertising. All of this stuff is ultimately about generating more money for the corporations that produce the content or have the news figures. I remember in the early 2000s coming home from my very first trip to the UK, and they have a very tabloid politics over there, and they have had like a National Enquirer, style politics for a very long time. And I remember reading a magazine on the plane, and it was like proclaiming that tabloid politics was coming to America. And here it is. That's all we have now. So,
and like I said, I want to be very careful. I'm sure they're very well intentioned and, authentic and sincere folks in every of these areas, in all of these areas, right? In the media and whatnot. But there is a natural driving force behind that you only make it if, right? I mean, nobody ever says the super honest guy that's a politician. Well, I mean, if he was all that, then he wouldn't have gotten into politics, right? I mean, because you have to sell. You have to be for sale. You have to be willing to give something up. When your position, when your job is about eternal compromise, then you've already kind of opened the floodgates, right? You're willing to compromise your beliefs in order to achieve this greater goal, whatever it is. And the same with the media. I mean, these reporters and these folks who really authentically want to do good work cannot do their work if they do not get paid, do not have a job. Well, how do they get a job? Well, you got to get people listening. Well, how do I get people listening? You got to create, there's got to be drama. So they're forced to create this drama. And well, I'll get to the things that I really want to get to as a politician after I get the job. I'll get to the things that I really want to get to help people out in the media after I get this next gig. And the same thing with the pundits and everything. It's
so the system is kind of set up so that people leapfrog over their true convictions to reach their material goals, essentially, and they postpone the good action, but then they run out of time.
I don't think politicians go into politics to be corrupt.
Yeah, I don't think
journalists go into journalism to be deceptive. To your point is what I'm saying. I don't believe that to be the case. I think that in order to be successful demands it, and therein lies the challenge.
So we have to change the demands.
You create that slippery, once you start falling down that slippery slope, it gets steeper and longer and uglier. And then the next thing you know, you forgot what you were there for in the first place.
So that's where we're at as a society right now. And that's why a lot of us have to take that independent route and relearn how to just be neighborly with each other and tell stories and create new legends and create new ways to celebrate our culture, because the corporate train is, like you said, it's a race to the bottom to maintain the ratings, to maintain the lifestyle, to maintain the cost of everything. It's a race to the bottom for these people.
I don't believe these are all bad or evil people who fall or become susceptible to those temptations. I think they have become accustomed to rationalizing their decisions for what the quote unquote greater good is. And I'm not a big greater good guy. I think if you do the little things right, the big things will work out well.
Oh yeah. I mean, the interactions are between ourselves. Yeah. Right. I'm with you on that one.
Yeah. I mean, if as a whole, we were all acting with integrity in the little day-to-day things, then the big stuff's going to work itself out. If we go chasing the big, but are willing to throw these other things away, well, by the time we have an opportunity to actually do something, we've sold ourselves off so much that we've got nothing left to give.
Yeah, that's a pleasant note where we can end this off tonight. We've got nothing left to give, ladies and gentlemen. Here's my last question for you, and this is really the most important thing I want to ask you.
Uh-oh.
Because it's something that that I don't understand. On a personal level, I really don't understand your fascination with Canada Dry ginger ale. When did that start? Have you always been this ginger ale fanatic? Like, what is your obsession with ginger ale? Why is that your favorite drink? Did you have it as a child? Is it special to you? Was it always available? And like, what? It seems like you have a really good relationship with Canada Dry.
I think it was very smart of you to save this question for the end, because this interview is over.
Yeah.
The fact that you say you don't understand is baffling to me. Boy, I don't know what to tell you. I had it growing up. It was, like I said, I have five kids and I am a sympathetic eater. You can call it whatever you want. I enjoy it no matter what occasion. But when my wife was pregnant, I would get cravings all the time.
Yeah.
I felt like I was doing her a favor. Oh, you have
take
a craving,
them for the
so
team, honey.
Right. Let me help you out. You're not alone. It's not you. It's me.
Yeah.
This
calzone is fantastic.
That's right. I have a craving. Let's go get a cheeseburger. So we were in, I think it was Michaela. It was my second. We're living in Louisiana. And we were on an Everybody Loves Raymond kick. And in Everybody Loves Raymond, he frequently goes over to the refrigerator, pulls out those small, you know, those small glass bottles of ginger ale.
Yes.
He would pull one of those out, take a swig, hold it, you know, for the rest of the scene, whatever the case. And I saw that one time and I'm like, gosh, I really want a ginger ale. So I went and got one, and I have, I mean, it is,
Ray Romano
make me speechless. Ginger ale does that to me.
So basically Ray Romano is your ginger ale dealer who got you hooked.
It is the first taste is free.
Yeah.
I've been enthralled with it ever since. I always have it at the house. It is the Lord's nectar as far as I'm concerned.
Amazing.
It makes everything taste better.
There's nothing better than knowing what you like and having it available in abundance.
That's but everything in moderation.
That's true. But I will say, in the most kismet way, I grew up about a block and a half away from the Canada Dry factory. And in my hometown, you would have just been in heaven. Because
you are such
a
snob.
No, we could go to the factory, and everybody knew someone who worked there. You could go to the factory and they would give you free ginger ales, cold.
Oh, man.
Or any of their other products. So it was
my own, I guess. They responded to a few of my tweets. I don't know if you've seen that.
I know. I think you're going to be sponsored by ginger ale in no time.
I was retweeted once by Jerry Seinfeld, which was great. You can imagine.
Oh, I'm sure.
Really neat. You know, the idea that it was a funny or supposed to be a funny-ish tweet. So the idea that maybe I made Jerry Seinfeld chuckle for a second was great. But nothing compares to getting a response from ginger ale.
Hey, people won't know who Seinfeld is in 20 years. Canada Dry is
going to be
around.
They don't know who Jerry Seinfeld is. Although the people that are listening to your podcast, I would presume.
I know, but Canada Dry is going to be is going to be around forever. As a matter of fact, it'll probably be, as if I can expect your taste to be accurate, it probably will be the nectar that is served in the next life. So,
oh boy, wouldn't that be great?
Right. So, dude, thank you for coming on my podcast, which essentially is about the storytelling narratives that are used against the public. And I tried to squeeze as much as I could out of you that you could say on this podcast about how law enforcement is used by the media, how you feel about it. And I just, you know, I thank you for coming on and talking with me about that in this open forum. And I hope people learn some things, and I really, really hope that people mark down that you have a book coming out, because I think it's going to be an important contribution to understanding how to avoid this trap in the future. We have to have much more knowledge about the way everything works. And so thank you for doing that work and taking one for the team and writing this difficult book that we're all going to really appreciate.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's been an absolute honor. I'm happy to be here, happy to be working on this project. This is great. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll see you on the tweet sphere.
That's right. We'll see you out there, buddy.
Thank you for tuning in to the Sub Pop Cult podcast. I hope that you enjoyed my conversation with former acting head of public corruption, Jeff Cortese. I hope that you can look at the media presentation of law enforcement in television shows and law enforcement in the news, and you can discern the difference and maybe help us get to the bottom of what is going on.